Succession number 28496, Reel 5.
So with the Reel 5, in 1965, I believe you were AOE of the Royal Navy Test Squadron.
Yes, yes. When I finished in the Admiralty, they have an officer who deals with all your movements and appointments and things, and I was down to go to Kildrose for the Gannet squadron there, but he rang me up and said he'd got a date mixed up and would I like to be the Air Engineer Officer of the Naval Test Squadron. And of course, everybody wants to get into research and development if they can. So I said I was absolutely delighted. So I went to Blackburns, did a course on the Buccaneers, went to Rolls-Royce, did a course on the Spey.
What did both of those involve? What was the course at Blackburn about? Was it a familiarisation with the Buccaneer, or was it very specific to the aircraft and its introduction?
Well, the Mark II Buccaneer had many similarities with the Mark I, which was in service. And, you know, the week that you spend up at Blackburn's, they tell you all about the aircraft, because it's quite a complicated aircraft. And it's really telling you all about the systems and so on and how everything works. And then a week at Rolls-Royce, all about the Spey. And not so much the basic gas turbine, but all the bits and pieces that go with it. The control rooms and acceleration and speed controllers and all the various bits and pieces. One funny bit on that course is there was a German on the course, and because they must have been getting the Spey in some aircraft. The design of the flame tubes in a gas turbine is a bit of a guess and try, and the people up there, Brough, were calling it a suck and see system. And eventually this German stood up and said, "That is the suck and see! Suck it and see!" Anyway, having done that course, then off you go down to Boscombe Down, where we're a compact naval unit in this in the Royal Air Force station there. And Boscombe Town's job really is like the Good Housekeeping Institute of the aviation industry, that the aircraft say the aircraft will do this and that, and you make sure it does. And then the aircraft start appearing. The first one we had was one which had been converted from a Mark I to a Mark II, so it was not quite standard. It just had the Spey engine instead of the Gyron Juniors. And of course the Spey fortunately had a couple of nice large alternators, so there was plenty of electricity for the aircraft, and the hot air device which had been in the back end of the Mark I wasn't needed in the Mark II. And so one of the problems, or one of the things that you have to do in the test establishments, is you have to instrument the aircraft. And so you have all sensors all over the aircraft which are checking various things. I mean, you even have bits of the engine painted with paint which will change colour if it gets too hot and so on. And, for example, you could change the engine, the Spey engines in a research Buccaneer in half a day, but it would take you a week to switch over all the instrumentation. And you get the aircraft and you start putting it through all its trials, and you take it aboard carriers, do the deck trials, and you also have to do a hot weather trial, which most of the trials from Boscombe had been done in Idris in Libya, which was, it was no longer possible to use. And the CEO and myself and the Air Force officer went around looking for places. We went out to Mazir, which was fine for the aeroplanes, but they didn't have the photographic facilities that you need for dealing with all the instrumentation. And eventually we ended up taking the Buccaneer to the States for its hot weather trials. And we flew them from Boscombe to Keflavik in Iceland, and then to Goose Bay in Labrador, then down to Patuxent River in Maryland, and then on to Pensacola. And our support aircraft was an Argosy. And then you have the problem of deciding what you carry in the Argosy to deal with a strange aircraft on strange airfields. and hoping that you don't find yourself stuck with something you haven't got.
What types of things did you have to take with you?
Well, obviously wheels and tyres, brake parts, things like that. Loads of electrical and radio bits. But, and of course the ladders for the aircrew getting on and off the aircraft, which are peculiar to the aircraft. And you just hope that you don't get a major force landing somewhere, because you can't possibly carry all the lifting gear with you. And anyway, of course the Buccaneer flew off first, and then we would follow it, and two flew up to Keflavik. I mean, I can this way, is it Reykjavik or Keflavik? Which is a civil airport? I can't remember now. Anyway, we spend the night in Iceland, and then we fly on to Goose Bay in Labrador, and overnight there, refuel the aircraft, and off they go next morning down to Patuxent River. And then we go down to Pensacola, and quite a large party had flown over by civil air. We'd also had an advance party which had gone there to supervise the offloading of stores from a ship and various other things, and they'd gone in a Hastings, and the Americans had asked them if they'd made it themselves. Now, this was just before they had a fatal accident with Hastings, which is why we ended up with an Andover. Anyway, we did all our work in Pensacola. We did our deck trials in the USS Lexington, which all went off very well. And when we'd finished, there's an annual changeover between the test pilots every year. And the Americans were threatening to charge $1,000 an hour for the next year. So we took the Buccaneer around test flight establishments in the States and let them fly for nothing. We took it over to Edwards Air Force Base. And our senior pilot flew it from Edwards back to Patuxent River, which was about 300 miles more than the Atlantic crossing. And then when on our way home, our CO flew the thing from Goose Bay to Lossiemouth, which was the first naval single-engined flight across the Atlantic.
With the deck trials,
yeah.
What's the kind of pattern of deck trials? What would you do in while you're doing the trials?
Well, you take the aircraft onto the carrier, and you load it up with fuel, and you load it up with inert 1,000-pound bombs, and then you fire it off the catapult of the carrier. To make sure that it can do this in the hot weather.
So it's just to observe the performance of the aircraft, is it, in that situation, in hot climates?
Yes, and you're also measuring the things that are happening to the engines and all that sort of thing, and the aircraft itself, and you've got scientists from Boscombe down from the various departments there who are getting their results. And, of course, you do the landings. And another useful thing, of course, is that you're proving that the aircraft is interchangeable between the two services. And, in fact, the Americans made a film about cross-servicing with the Buccaneer while we were there, which I've never seen, actually.
Can you give me a thumbnail sketch of the Buccaneer? You said it's one of your favourite aircraft, but can you describe it verbally for me, what it's like?
It's a twin-engined aircraft. It's with a very streamlined fuselage, two cockpits, pilot and observer, slightly offset so that the observer can see behind the pilot. There's a very long bomb bay in the aircraft which rotates. Most unusual, the bombs are inside the aircraft. The space above the bomb bay in the fuselage is full of 8 fuel tanks, which are normally filled through a ground connection. The after end of the aircraft is full of electronics and so on. It has a very, very, very high tail. It has some clamshell dive brakes at the back, a arrestor hook at the back. There's a very, very strong structure going through the aircraft out to the stub planes. It is very, very strong. And on this you've got a very substantial undercarriage, and then you've got the wings which fold. To get such a heavy aircraft down to a suitable speed for our carriers, you have what is called blow or boundary layer. So some air is bled off from the compressor in the engines, and out in the leading edge of the wings and the tailplane, so that it maintains the airflow over the wing at a higher angle of attack, letting the aircraft land at a higher speed. There are various attachments on the wing for carrying other weapons, rocket launchers and so on, and later various missiles. And Buccaneer was a very, very strong aircraft. The Air Force took it and were pleased with this. And they had some problems, but I think that was really, the Buccaneer was designed to fly over the sea. And when you started flying over the land, you were getting more turbulence than you get over the sea. So they did have a few problems.
Was it a versatile aircraft?
Yes, because you could use it as a dive bomber, you could use it to deliver missiles. It was really designed to get rid of the Sverdlov-class cruisers an atomic bomb. And it was designed to throw these bombs at the aircraft, at the ship, in a toss maneuver, so the aircraft could then pull out and be as far away from the explosion as possible.
Did you enjoy that period when you were there? Was that one of your awesome?
The best bit ever, definitely, because it was very, very interesting, you see, being at Boscombe Down, because of all the other things that were going on there. You know, there were V-bombers, TSR-2. In fact, the TSR took over our hangar. Had half of it first and then all of it. And I missed the TSR-2's first flight by about 20 minutes. Once we just got back from a deck trial in Eagle, and I waited and waited, and I thought, blow it, I'm going home. And I just missed it.
What did you think of the TRS?
Well, I don't know that I can really truly assess it. It was a very advanced aeroplane. It would have been very, very expensive. But I think it would have been a good one. And when you think that they cancelled it and then fiddled around with the F-111 and didn't get any F-111s, it's all a lot of waste of money, isn't it?
What was the next move? Where did you go to?
Oh, I went back into the Naval Air Repair Organization. I tried to get out of it. But on the other hand, there were a lot of people there that I knew. Because some of the civilians who had moved down from Donnybristol from there, and also the naval people who were in the involved with the Naval Air Repair Organization tended to stay with it. You see, I had an Admiralty, Donnybristol and Fleetland. And my major job there was planning the overhaul of the Sea King engine. The main reason why it had to be replanned, of course, because it was horizontal in the Sea King and it had been used at various angles in the other aircraft. So one had to make a different test bed. It was a slightly more powerful engine, some different toolings. And all the time in the gas turbine business, there are always new processes coming along. Cleaning processes, anti-corrosive processes, crack detection testing. And this is something that's going on all the time. So you have to find out about all this, and also at the same time they were introducing network analysis and PERT charts. So 2 weeks into the job, the chap I've relieved has gone, and I have to explain how to use PERT charts. that's the sort of thing that happens to you all the time in the Navy. We also got involved, of course, in going around the aircraft factories who build the engine. And because Rolls-Royce tools are so expensive, we made a lot of them ourselves in the Naval Air Repair Organization. So that meant and Perth was the best place for this sort of thing, so that meant travelling up to Perth again. And then the army decided they would have some hovercraft. And of course the inter-service hovercraft unit was at Leon Solent. So it was decided that we would service the hovercraft for number 4 squadron, I think the Royal Corps of Transport it was called at the time. And then you realise the difference between the services, because in the Navy you get something called a depot task for your stores, and they will send you a selection of all these items. The Army sent us a computer printout and we waited for the spares and nothing happened. What they wanted us to do was to pick what we wanted, you know. Anyway, also at the same time they decided that they ought to have a hovercraft in the Falklands, because some Argentinians had landed in a small aircraft there on the race course, real large field, and they thought there are no roads in the Falklands, they ought to have a hovercraft. So they purchased an SRN-6, and one of my jobs at Fleetlands was involving preparing this thing for military service. We wanted more fuel, so we found that I think the middle third of a Scimitar fuel tank with flat ends on it would fit in the cabin. I've mentioned before taking air off an engine, there was a customer air bleed on the Gnome engine where you could run various things, so you could bleed some air off from that and blow the fuel from this tank back into the main fuel tank. You also switch the radar and radio to service stuff, and of course you try to make the hovercraft Royal Marine bootproof. But of course if you put too much weight in a hovercraft, it's not going to hover. Anyway, the hovercraft was finished and sent off to the Falklands, and I never saw a Sea King engine go through Fleetlands, because the test bed hadn't been finished. I had one interesting job there. We did a reorganisation and the water level there was a foot and a half down, and we wanted to put a vehicle pit in the hangar, so we arranged all sorts of quick cutting devices, quick setting cement and so on, dug a hole in the ground, and we were in the middle of an enormous lump of clay and we didn't need any of it. And that was, I got into terrible trouble on this reorganisation. I forgot to move the bike racks. Anyway, when that was over, I got sent to Daedalus on Matsu, the Mobile Aircraft Repair, Transport and Salvage Unit, which had a mass of Queen Marys and cranes and specially trained repair people. And at that time, instead of taking aircraft out of service for an overhaul at X years, we used to go and survey them. If they were in reasonable good condition and perhaps needed just a few repairs, and because most of the blokes in the field are not au fait with repair work, we would send a team out to do the repair work and leave the aircraft in service for a bit longer. And we used to survey them where they were. So chaps from my unit were all over the world. And the hovercraft came due for its first overhaul, first survey, and as I've been involved with it, I thought I will pop out of the Falklands. So I went out the Falklands and did the survey, and then a couple of chaps would go out later and do any work that was needed. The second year it was due, nobody wanted to go to the Falklands, so I went again.
What was the Falklands like at that time?
Well, it was very, very quiet. There were no roads, except in the capital. You went around by Land Rover as far as you could, boat, or the Falkland Islands Government Air Service float planes. Visitors were so unusual that you were interviewed on the radio, and you had to have dinner with the governor. So you had to take out a dinner suit, but we gave up in the end and borrowed them. Your time down there, of course, depended on the vessel that took you there and collected all the sheep wool. And your survey only took a few days, so you had a bit of spare time. So they would whistle you around to see all the penguins and elephant seals and things. And I can't remember if it was the first or second time I was out there, the BBC were out there doing the stills for the salvage of the Great Britain. So I got to know all those people and went round the Great Britain with them when they were sussing it out, you know, before the salvage. So that was quite interesting. And getting there was quite a business. You flew to New York, and then with Varig down to Rio, Buenos Aires, Montevideo, and then the boat down to the Falklands, and back the same way. The second time, we were supposed to be going with Air France from Senegal to Rio, but they went on strike, so we were, two of us, the marina was going to inspect the marines out in the Falklands. We were sent to London Airport to report to British Airways, who sent us to Miami, and then we flew with Lanchili down Quito, Galley, Kayakia, Santiago, all these other places in the Boeing 737, which is not the world's best aeroplane, if you're in the business. And but after this chap had done three landings in the night in the mountains, we realised he was doing more landings in a day than the work chap did in a week, so we stopped worrying about him.
And what was the, after that, was that your retirement from the Navy?
Yes, yes. Yes, I. It was quite odd in a way because the Admiral Leon Solent, whose staff I was on, had been was a lieutenant in the other Swordfish Squadron, and I was on his staff when he retired from the Navy. So it was really a complete circle. And when I finally retired, there was this. This combination between the Air Force and the Navy fleet arm going on again, and there was an argument about that the Air Force maintenance units would take over all this transfer and repair work and so on. But we went to a meeting to sort it out, and the split up was that the Air Force did the fixed wing aircraft and the Navy did the rotary wing aircraft for all three services. So really, the chap in charge of MARTSU was responsible for this transport, salvage and repair of rotary wing aircraft for all three services worldwide. And I went to Jib and Singapore, Hong Kong, Providence, Rhode Island, Malta, Cyprus. Did quite a lot of charging around. My wife got really fed up with it, you see, because she couldn't go on any of these trips. And it's an odd thing, retiring from the Navy, but because I got this job in the Royal Aircraft Establishment, where there were naval officers as well as Air Force officers, and there was in fact still a mess, it was really just, in a way, just a continuation of my old career in a civilian suit.
And that was at Bedford?
Yes.
Your role was a servicing manager, what did that entail?
Well, it was running all the servicing of the aircraft and the fitting in them of all the equipment that the scientists wanted. And the aircraft varied from a VC-10 down to an Oster. We had virtually a squadron of Canberras when Pershaw closed and we got their task. We had Harriers. We did the ski jump trials. We had arresting gear and a catapult there, raised in a flush steam catapult, and so you could test all this stuff ashore. And originally I was just had the aircraft service, then I got the whole airfield, and then I think they decided that was a bit too much, and one of the engineers on the wind tunnel site, he took over the steam catapults and the arresting gear and so on. We also had a rolling platform for testing helicopters, small ships, and a VTOL pits where you could get a VTOL aircraft to land without ground effect. You know, an enormous pit with a grid over it and concrete chutes underneath to take all the efflux away. And that was really a very, very interesting job. And some of the work we were doing was the modern flight deck display, which is, you know, sort of television screens instead of round dials. And first of all, you have a black and white one, and then you get round to colour. And we did a lot of work for aircraft noise to try and the noise reduction. And that involves flying aircraft with silencers on and measuring the noise. And to do that, they stick the microphones on top of the Severn Bridge or hang it off a balloon. And you get aircraft, because you've got all the kinetheodolites and all the equipment, you get aircraft from the manufacturers sometimes coming in to do measured takeoffs. And we also did trials on this idea that you could make a deep plastic cover on the end of a runway if there was a town near the end of it, with a skin on the top of it, strong enough to support fire engine and ambulances. But you could, an aircraft would go into it, and it would slow up the aircraft. So one of our pilots drove an old Comet into this system, which worked, but I don't think it was ever used on any runways. And of course, the most adjacent one, which was Hong Kong, they built a new one.
And when you finish from there, you
have to go from there? Oh gosh, well, I was due to retire, and in fact I was looking for a final retirement home in Weymouth, which is where my wife's choice. She was given the choice after all our charging around. And then they started contractorising some of the RE establishments, and West Frew was one of them. And Flight Refueling got the contract for running the airfield, along with RCA, who did the range. And the chap that they wanted for the airfield manager there was not acceptable to the RE, and they said, have you got anybody retiring who might like the job? And my name was put forward. And so it was back to West Frew. And it's quite interesting, because the guy who put my name forward found it was all right working for this firm, and he came to work for them later on.
And I believe there's something significant in your final retirement day, isn't there?
Oh yes, it's exactly 50 years from the day that I signed on. I took the King's Shilling at Halton on the 12th of January 1937, and I handed in my pass at West Frew on the 11th of January 1987.
Thank you very much, Ted.
Okay.